2. The Age of Abbas I and the Shaping of the Safavid Empire, 1588-1666. Few rulers in Iranian history are as idealized in public memory as Abbas I, and few epochs as cherished as his reign, 1588-1629. He was seen, and with reason, as an empire builder who rose to the challenges of his time, shaping them as much as he was shaped by them. The legend of Abbas the Great does not tell us the whole story, of course, but it reflects something of the historical reality. His was a success story that started with dim chances of surviving, let alone retrieving his lost kingdom, but he managed to overcome many domestic and foreign obstacles to build a centralized state of power and prosperity. Perhaps his most enduring legacy is that he helped birth a national community and culture that outlasted him and his dynasty. The Age of Abbas endured not only in public buildings and public memory, coinage and caravanserais, but also in the spirit of urban tranquility, artistic and intellectual creativity, and commercial vigour that he patronised. To the Europeans who frequented his realm, the Grand Sophie of Shakespeare's plays was a natural ally and a gracious host, interested in the affairs of their world. To modern historians, the contrast of Abbas's complex personality, civil and considerate, yet crafty and cruel, curious and visionary, yet insecure and paranoid, present a formidable case study of Persian kingship. A man of small but muscular stature, with a dark complexion, Abbas shaved off his beard entirely, but kept droopy moustaches. Dressed in plain clothes, in deliberate contrast to his opulent surroundings and the extravagant outfits of his attendants, it was as if he was implying to others his innate majestic qualities in the guise of ordinary man. He wore a self-styled cap, different from the kesbelash crown of his ancestors, always wearing his sword and ready to use it to intimidate or to punish. He impressed many observers and European visitors in particular as an agile, almost restless warrior, but confident and well-informed. The Roman nobleman Pietro della Valle, who visited Abbas in 1618, when the Shah was 49 years old, describes him as extremely shrewd, highly alert, and valiant. Bilingual, he conversed in Persian and Azerbaijani Turkish, often in a congenial tone. Though informal and often inclined toward leisure, wine, music, and nocturnal gatherings, he was unpredictable and at times extremely violent and vindictive. Of Abbas's three sons, one was killed in secret at his instigation, and the other two were blinded and imprisoned for life on apparently unfounded suspicions of plotting against their father. Abbas had little compunction about executing victims personally, at times in the presence of foreign envoys. He was also a model of a hands-on, absolute ruler, distrustful of ministerial power and of his Gezelbash army chiefs. Impressing Della Valle with a panoramic knowledge of European imperial politics, complete with anti-Ottoman sentiment and disillusionment with European powers' disunity, Protestant movements and religious wars, he implicitly criticised Philip II's military strategy and the reasons for Spanish domestic troubles. He went on to say, "An emperor must himself be a soldier and personally lead troops into battlefield. A ruler cannot leave the destiny of his country in the hands of his ministers and army chiefs. Such a king is bound for misfortune. People are often thinking of their own interest, and have no other concern but to earn wealth and power so as to lead a comfortable and joyful life. They hence fail to fully discharge their duties. Rulers should thus be model for all." Della Valle added that the Shah believed a capable ruler either should destroy the enemy, or bring it to submission, or himself die on the battlefield. Rebuilding the Empire. From the outset of his reign, Abbas showed clear signs of independence. His model of rule was neither the crusading king-prophet of Ismail I, nor the pious balancing of power of his grandfather Tahmasp. It was as though, through the experience of his father's reign, and his own 7 years as crown prince in Khorasan with a shaky future, he nurtured deep resentment toward the Gezelbash hegemony. To survive, he was convinced he had to break the back of the Turkmen aristocracy, a course that had been tried and failed by his predecessors. avenging the murders of his mother and his slain brother, Hamze Mirza, who earlier had unsuccessfully contested the hegemony of the Kizilbash. Abbas orchestrated a masterful purge that soon eliminated a number of important Kizilbash chiefs on charges of treason and by fomenting internecine hostilities. By 1589, even his own regent and guardian, Murshed Goli Khan Hastajlu, fell victim of the purge. How was the power of the Kizilbash crushed with relative ease? The answer can be found as much in the erosion of Turkmen's solidarity as in the dwindling fighting force they could muster after a ruinous civil war. The career of Murshed Goli himself illustrates the rise and fall of a new kind of emir, different from the rustic Sufi crusaders of Ismail's time. He was the grandson of a camel driver and son of an Ostajlu soldier. His father rose through the ranks under Tahmasp to become the commander-in-chief of Khorasan and guardian of the then-infant Abbas Mirza in Herat, before being slain during the chaos of Ismail II's reign. Despite his personal ambition and abundant energy, however, over the years, Murshed's fighting force dwindled. With numbers at times reaching as low as 1,000 horsemen, the loyalty of the Kizilbash rank and file, which no longer was entirely based on kinship, shifted rapidly from one adventure to another. It was the erosion of this fighting power and the breakdown of clan loyalties that enabled the young Abbas to arrange and personally supervise his own regent's violent murder, as he had done with many other Kizilbash emirs. Abbas shrewdly appealed to the Kizilbash rank and file by nurturing a new spirit of loyalty toward the person of the Shah. What came to be known as Shahisivan, love for the Shah, rooted in early Safavid memory of allegiance to the person of the king, contrasted solidarity along the tribal ranks. Abbas exploited this sense of solidarity not only to undermine the Kizilbash elite, but also to uphold it as a principle, a political motto, and even an institution upon which he could rebuild the Safavid army and administration. The Shahisivan made it possible to break tribal bonds, juxtapose the command structure of Kizilbash contingents, and create new detachments of different ethnic origins, including Tajik Persians, Arabs from southern Iran, and the Deylam of Gilan province, as well as Georgian, Armenian, and Circassian Gholams. Greater reliance on the slave element, in particular, shifted the balance in favour of the Shah. The Kizilbash did not disappear as an identity or as a privileged rank, but it was effectively stripped of its status as a cohesive tribal elite in control of a semi-autonomous military force. Abbas's defence policy also involved a complex chess game of playing the Turkish tribes within non-Turkish regions off one another. To build a defence barrier against Uzbek incursions, for example, he resettled, similar to the style of the neighbouring Ottomans, large divisions of the Kizilbash in northeastern frontiers. By the early 17th century, as many as 4,500 Afshar families of the Aramiya region of Azerbaijan, some 30,000 families of Belbas Kurds of Erzurum, as well as the Bayats and the Qajars from Erevan, Ganje, and Karabakh, in the southern Caucasus, were resettled in strategic locations in northern Khorasan and in Astarabad, in the eastern corner of Mozandaran. Massive reallocations such as these helped secure eastern Iran. Yet they also transformed Iran's nomadic patterns and put new strains on the limited pastoral resources. In due course, such tensions generated tribal conflict, well evident in the early 18th century rise of the Afshar and later the Qajar dynasties. The key to Abbas's Shahisivan solidarity and the cornerstone of his centralizing policy was the effective use of firearms. Although the manufacture and use of cannon and handguns were commonplace from the time of Tahmasp, it was largely due to Abbas's initiative that the use of firearms became prevalent in the Safavid army as instruments of both war against neighboring enemies and domestic security. As it turned out, this new military technology was the first step toward modernity. From around the 1590s until the first quarter of the 19th century, cannon became the most effective weapon in the Iranian arsenal, enabling the state, with few exceptions, to achieve eventual victory over domestic contenders and foreign onslaughts. It helped consolidate power in Abbas's hands, establish a rapport with Europe, and augmented Safavid Iran's image of itself as a victorious power. Acquiring cannon technology did not prove particularly difficult, given that by the turn of the 17th century, casting cannon was a relatively uncomplicated and inexpensive operation. Besides possessing an indigenous knowledge from even before Tahmasp's time, especially of casting makeshift siege cannon, there were enough military engagements with the Ottomans and enough renegades from the enemy's army to Iran to furnish the Safavids with their vital needs. Victories over the Ottomans, and later the Portuguese in the Persian Gulf, also provided the Safavids with cannon pieces as spoils of war. The arrival of European soldiers of fortune, moreover, rendered knowledge of modern warfare available to the Safavids. Yet, like Tahmasp before him, Abbas was selective in adapting the Ottoman and Western methods of warfare and military organization. The Safavids neither could afford nor were willing to abandon their highly mobile light cavalry, which, under capable command, continued to prove its worth. Equipped with artillery and reinforced by musketeer corps, for a limited time in the first half of the 17th century, the Safavid army reached an effective, optimal balance between the traditional methods of warfare and the new military technology and tactics. The artillery could pierce, if not shatter and raise to the ground, the seemingly impenetrable fortresses and strongholds that dotted the Iranian landscape and were even more numerous along the mountainous periphery of the Caucasus, Kurdistan, Luristan, Mozandaran, and eastern Khorasan. Abbas aimed not to raise, but to capture the semi-autonomous strongholds and to subordinate their khans, who had long fallen outside of Safavid control. It took him at least a decade to impose a semblance of tranquility in the Iranian interior. At times he faced the opposition not only of the Gezilbash and other local khans, but also of the local populace, city dwellers and peasants, who defied integration primarily because of the heavy taxation imposed on them to finance the state's military campaigns. Repeated uprisings throughout the early 1590s in the cities and countryside of Mozandaran, Abbas's own maternal homeland and a coveted province because of its natural resources, were but one example of challenges to the centralizing state. Despite regional resistance, however, the new imperial army imposed on the disparate and geographically scattered communities of Iran a new loyalty to the state as a guarantor of security and eventually national identity. What also gave Abbas's career a flavor of the common trends in the empires of the early modern times were a clearer sense of military strategy and political priorities. Far from reacting haphazardly to grave threats to his throne, as he had done at the outset of his reign, he recognized his priorities, planned his action, and waited for the right opportunities. He realized the futility of engaging in a destructive war with the Ottomans when such odds as shattered frontier defenses, trouble at home, traitorous khans, and a demoralized army were clearly against him. In 1590, aware of the hazards of a two-front engagement, he acquiesced to a humiliating peace treaty with the Ottomans that ceded the western Iranian provinces in their entirety to his powerful nemesis. Moreover, the treaty compelled the Safavids to renounce their most inveterate expression of Shi'i militancy, the cursing of the Sunni caliphs. The treaty, nonetheless, granted Abbas much-needed respite to pacify the interior and, some years later, to start the process that would end Uzbek occupation of the East. By 1598, in a series of campaigns, mostly under Abbas's own command, Safavid armies recouped their losses throughout Khorasan, including Herat, Mashhad, Balkh, Marv, and Astarabad. The capture of Herat in particular was a singular boost to the Safavids' morale, for it restored the Safavid claim to Timurid heritage. Regaining Mashhad further enhanced the Shah's stature as protector of Shi'i Islam. For the rest of the 17th century, all major urban centres of Khorasan remained in Safavid hands, a success that nevertheless proved fragile. The relative tranquility of Khorasan persuaded Abbas to begin the second phase of his strategy to reconquer the Iranian Empire, this time from the more formidable Ottoman occupiers. For this, He fielded 500 cannon and a corps of nearly 12,000 artillerymen and 12,000 musketeers, which included a mix of Iranians, Caucasian Gholams, and a reformed Shahisavan cavalry, now mostly identified by the general name Khachiz, weapons-bearers, or, more accurately, bearer of firearm. Though numerically far smaller than the Ottoman forces, this was a force to be reckoned with. In a series of brilliant campaigns between 1603 and 1612, Abbas routed his Ottoman enemy in Azerbaijan and the Eastern Caucasus, as much by his tact and creative use of limited resources as by his personal valour and high morale. In this, he ranked among the most talented military commanders of early modern times. Tabriz was recaptured in 1604, after nearly two decades of devastation, repeated changes of hands, and massacres of the local population. A 1612 Treaty of Istanbul, moreover, returned to Iran all the territory it had lost since the 1555 Peace of Amasya. Later, the Ottomans' repeated efforts to recoup their losses in western Iran brought even greater humiliation and more injury to their military reputation. In the following decade, Abbas used every opportunity to turn the Ottomans' strategic errors in northern and central Mesopotamia into his own gain, with the aim of pushing into the heartland of the Safavid movement and beyond. By 1623, the recapture of Baghdad and the Shi'i holy cities of Najaf and Karbala, which had been lost to the Safavids in 1535, marked the pinnacle of Abbas's career and the reunification of his formerly fractured empire. Isfahan, the nave of the Safavid universe. Coinciding with reconquest of Khorasan in 1598, Abbas began to relocate the Safavid capital from Ghazvin to Isfahan, in the heart of the Iranian plateau, long the seat of power to the Buyid and later the Seljukid empires of the 10th and 11th centuries. The shift was significant not only for ethnic, strategic, and economic reasons, but also because Abbas's reconstruction of Isfahan as his capital gave material expression to the achievements of his reign. The master plan and monumental architecture of the new capital epitomized power and legitimacy, as much as functionality, openness, and leisure, all in an atmosphere of candor and confidence. Isfahan, this quintessential Persian city, became even more representative of Safavid Iran under Abbas and his successors. As much as they shaped the city and its inhabitants also shaped them. European visitors of the period, who marveled at Isfahan's greatness and the mastermind behind its revival, also recorded traits of greater Persian homogeneity among the Safavid political elite. That Abbas opted for Isfahan as his capital, even after recapturing Herat, Tabriz, and Baghdad, all three had earlier been recognized as seats of imperial power, reveals geopolitical common sense. The city's pivotal location was recognized by Seljuk administrators, who apparently were the first to rhyme Isfahan with the epithet Nasfe Jahan, nave of the universe. In 1079, Omar Khayyam, approximately 1048 to 1141, the celebrated mathematician and astronomer of the Seljuk era and poet of the Rubaiyat, was among the astronomers who positioned Isfahan as the prime meridian, the Nasaf, of the reformed solar Jalali calendar, the most pronounced marker of Persian solar time reckoning and Iran's calendric memory. The emphasis in rhyme on the centrality of Isfahan should not be taken as mere glorification of the new capital, as metropolises often are labelled by their proud rulers and inhabitants. Even today, the common phrase, Isfahan Nasfe Jahan, Isfahan is half the world, reflects how the misreading of the original epithet Nesf, half, for Nasf, nave, centre, resulted in boosting the greatness of the city. Geographically, Isfahan was indeed the centre of the Safavid Empire. Located equidistant from the former capitals, Tabriz and Herat, it offered an ideal communicative and administrative advantage. In the face of the Ottomans' virtual trade blockade to the west, Isfahan's proximity to the Persian Gulf also offered alluring alternative access to European markets. Isfahan also was centrally located on the trade route at the edge of the central Iranian desert that connected Qazvin and Kashan to Yazd and Kerman and beyond to Kandahar and northern India. Nearly two decades of war and destruction had reduced Tabriz's enviable position as the hub of the Eurasian trade, a position that it would never regain, especially after the rise of Istanbul as the centre of trade in the eastern Mediterranean. Not yet fully recovered from the ravages of Timurid armies in the late 14th century, Isfahan, in contrast, offered abundant natural and human resources. Water from the river Zayanderud, meaning birthing river, for its riverbed springs, or Zenderud, the living river, supplemented by a network of subterranean ganats on the slopes of central Zagros range, irrigated the hinterlands of Isfahan. Without the bountiful and reliable food supplies harvested from the alluvial plains along the Zayanderud, the only major river in the interiors of the Iranian plateau, it would have been impossible for any state to sustain a large urban population, secure a thriving trade and industry, and maintain a standing army and extensive divan. By the time Abbas embarked on his new cosmopolitan project, his contemporary, the Mughal Emperor Akbar, reigned 1556 to 1605, had already abandoned his newly built capital in Fatehpur in 1586 because of the scarcity of water. The Ottoman capital, Istanbul, however, offered security, prosperity, and power because of its prime maritime location, which allowed for the importation of grain from and easy access to the Balkans, the Black Sea, and the Mediterranean. The people of Isfahan provided another incentive for transfer of the capital. Ever since the time of Ismail, Isfahanis had served in high offices, most notably Najma II, the capable Vakil, who was partially responsible for reassertion of the Persian Tajik element in the early Safavid administration. The gradual tilt toward the Iranian centre, at the expense of the Azerbaijan-based Kizilbash, signified the triumph of the Persian divan. It was perhaps with the famed and well-chronicled resourcefulness and diligence of the people of the new capital that Abbas found the greatest affinity. That they were also labelled shrewd and streetwise, even by native Isfahani authors, conveyed a sense of cosmopolitan confidence vital for the expansion of commerce. The potential for recruitment was not only in the expanding divan, but also in the growing trade network and in the famed royal workshops. Isfahan incorporated into its growing economic network industrial centres in its vicinity, such as Kashan, Yazd, and Kerman. Artistically, too, Isfahan soon absorbed the traditions of painting and calligraphy from Shiraz as well as Tabriz and Herat, displaying its own distinctive cultural characteristics. Initially a garrison town, indicated in its original name Sipahan, garrison, barracks, Isfahan's roots probably went back to a settlement of the Achaemenid period, which later gave rise to a sizable Jewish quarter. Among the oldest inscriptional evidence from the city, dating to the Parthian period, is a dedication tablet from a synagogue in the Jewish quarter. In pre-Safavid times, the Jewish quarter, known as Jubareh, Jewish borough, which survives into the present with the same name, may have controlled a sizable volume of trade and financing, important for Isfahan's economic well-being. The imperial legacy of Isfahan persuaded Abbas to bestow his stamp on the face of the city in the form of the new congregational Jameh Mosque, a masterwork of Perso-Islamic architecture. In the age of great construction projects around the globe, from Habsburg Spain to Ming China, the lure of monumentalizing political and military achievements was strong for Abbas, especially when the timing was coincidental with the turn of the first Islamic millennium. The years 1591 to 1592 corresponded to the year 1000 of the Islamic Hijra calendar. It is tantalizing to think that Abbas constructed the Isfahan monuments so as to commemorate his millennial stature. Suppressing the millenarian movement of the Noctavis shortly before moving to his new capital made Abbas's choice of a millennial capital even more plausible. A century after the rise of Ismail to power in 1501, corresponding to the Islamic calendar year 906, such a commemoration was even more fitting, for Abbas was able to recover once more the full length and breadth of his ancestors' domain while capturing the spirit of his forefathers' messianic revolution in the splendour of his own royal monuments. Not without reason, the zodiac sign associated with this Fahan, Sagittarius, Arabic Al-Ghaz, Persian Chaman, also associated with victorious rule in Perso-Islamic astrological culture, adorned the portal of the Caesariye Bazaar, from Arabic Caesar, from Latin Caesar, in the Naqsh-e-Jahan Royal Square. As with the nomenclature in use in Cairo during the Fatimid era of the 10th and 11th century, in Isfahan too, power and glory were associated with the city's investiture as a millennial metropolis. Between 1598 and 1629, the end of his life, Abbas added a new sector to the old city, and all available evidence suggests that its construction was guided by at least a rudimentary master plan he devised himself. The plan consisted of a complex of mosques and madrasas, a massive square, thoroughfares, bazaars, pavilions, and gardens. The buildings were meant to visually display royal grandeur, as well as Abbas's utilitarian appetite for business and his taste for leisure. Perhaps most symbolic in this emerging urban space was the Meydan Naqsh-e-Jahan, first developed in 1590 on the site of a Seljuk garden of the same name. It was a rectangle, 512 metres long and 159 metres wide, an expansive multifunctional space, connected through a covered bazaar to the old section of the city and through a network of state buildings and royal gardens to the newly constructed recreational thoroughfare known as the Chahar Bagh, four-part garden. The concept of the Meydan, from the Middle Persian for empty space in the middle, as it applied to the Naqsh-e-Jahan, Naqsh, model or pattern, and Jahan, the world, was reminiscent of the city's dual functions as a garrison and a trade centre, but also of the symbolic representation of the state. The old Meydan in Isfahan was located in front of the original Congregational Mosque on the other end of the bazaar, which in its own right was a repository of Iran's architectural history. Naqsh-e-Jahan, while maintaining these old functions, displayed the royal touch on all sides. Most notable was its accessibility and openness, in contrast to virtually all other royal projects carried out elsewhere in the early modern world, perhaps with the notable exception of Venice's Piazza San Marco. The new Meydan was not modelled as a citadel, Arg, with high walls and closed gates barring the public from mingling with the royals and their officials, as so many royal projects were, from the Spanish El Escorial to Istanbul's Topkapi to Delhi's Lal Gala, the Red Fort, and Beijing's Forbidden City, and later Versailles. Naqsh-e-Jahan, on the contrary, housed around its perimeter public buildings together with royal pavilions, suggesting to observers a spirit of communal unity. It was as though it were intended to be the pattern for the emerging Safavid world. This microcosm of the Safavid guarded domains was a deliberate mix of sacred and profane. The arched modular arcade around the Meydan, consisting of rows of shops, was interrupted at four points by monumental edifices. On the southern end was the magnificent Royal Mosque, symbolic of the enduring presence of Shi'ism, and on the northern end was the picturesque gateway to the bazaar. These public spaces alternated with two royal structures. On the west, the Royal State House, Dowlat Khane-e Mubarakeh, better known by its Turkish name Ali Gapi, or the Sublime Threshold, and on the east, the Royal Chapel, better known as the Mosque of Sheikh Lutfallah al-Maisi, after the scholar of Jabal al-Amil, in whose honour apparently the chapel was named. The space in the middle was an expansive ground used for a variety of purposes, the Persian game of polo and other games, military parades, weekly trade fairs with tents and caravans, and festive gatherings with fireworks, nighttime illumination, musical bands, and entertainers. Not infrequently, Abbas himself appeared on the veranda of the Royal State House to view a parade or to observe the Muharram mourning ceremonies, and he mingled freely with the Isfahani public in the Meydan spirit of pageantry and camaraderie. Having been advised by an Isfahani merchant turned state official on the Meydan project, the Shah was mindful of ensuring a return on his invested capital. The first modern commercial development project reflected the empire's new spirit of state mercantilism. Shops in the arcade were rented out at a discounted rate to encourage a different business pattern from that of the occupational clusters of the bazaar. A stone channel ran around the perimeter of the Maidan, serving as a divider between the central arena and a covered walkway around the square. The shaded passageway served the clientele with Persian and European luxury goods, which were becoming increasingly affordable for the prosperous classes, heralding a new age of affluence and consumption. Remarkably, the new Maidan was not divorced from the fabric of the old city. Rather, it was a modern extension of it. The Royal Congregational Mosque, endowed by Abbas and named after him, the Masjid-e Jame' Abbasi, or simply known as the Shah Mosque before it was renamed in 1980, in blatant violation of the Islamic requirement to preserve the name of the founder of any charitable endowment as the Imam Khomeini Mosque, was designed by the royal architect Badi al-Zamane Tuni, about whom we know nothing beyond his name. The mosque was built between 1611 and 1638 by a team of architects, engineers, masons, ceramic tile artists, and calligraphers under Abbas's close supervision. Masterfully integrated into the Maidan complex, the entrance portal was aligned with the Maidan's axis, while the main courtyard, the 52-metre turquoise-coloured tile dome, and the rest of the building are turned 45 degrees to face toward Mecca, a requirement for any mosque. The symbolism could hardly be missed by any observer. From any point in the Maidan, one could appreciate the harmony between the secular space, dominated by the state building and its commercial ventures, and the sacred ambiance of the mosque's interiors. Accessed from the Maidan through a tilted corridor, the contrast between the sacred and profane is further nuanced by the dimmed light in the intermediate space. The harmony between the two spaces is nevertheless accentuated by the resemblance in the design of the polychrome ceramic portals that stand on opposite sides. To complement the mosque, the royal chapel of Sheikh Lotfullah on the eastern flank of the Maidan was a cherished example of Safavid architecture. The ambiance of this building, which lacked a courtyard and featured an off-center dome, was distinct from the traditional design of Persian mosques. It may have been originally planned to serve a function other than a mosque, possibly a madrasa or even a gathering place for the Sufis of the Safavi order, who still maintained a ceremonial position, albeit a much diminished one, at the Safavid court. The royal state house on the western side of the square is testament to the greater prominence of the Safavid state. First begun under Abbas as a multi-story atrium for the complex of royal palaces and gardens behind it, under Abbas's successors, it evolved into a state house with new music chambers and banquet halls. An exterior symbol of the state, perhaps comparable in function to the Ottoman Sublime Porte, Bab-e Ali, or Divan-am in Mughal Delhi, the cubic structure and multiple stories of the state house represented a breakthrough in Safavid design and interior decoration. Moreover, perhaps for the first time in Persian architecture, its positioning on one side of the Maidan removed the seat of government from the seclusion of the citadel and placed it squarely in public view. As a state house, it was placed in a separate building outside the court and more accessible to the public. Preceding Naqsh-e Jahan, the Doge's Palace in Piazza San Marco in Venice seems to be the only other government building of the time that shared a similar conceptual character and served a similar function. The innovative design of the Royal State House was in harmony with the new Maidan complex. Not only could the Shah's subjects see him on public occasions on the balcony of the State House, but also the government could also be more easily accessed independent of the royal court and the overpowering presence of the monarch. The spatial differentiation between the state and the royal household, in effect between the private and the public functions of the Shah, was a tantalizing overture to a modern political division of labor. Yet such a division of private and public in the state's affairs never really materialized under the Safavids or their successors. While the lower floors of the seven-story building housed the headquarters of the two most important officers of the Safavid state, the vizier as head of the divan and the sadr as head of the religious administration, The upper floors functioned as reception halls for entertaining royal guests. From the heavily ornate upper floors with hedonistic wall paintings by the 17th century master painter Reza Abbasi to the elaborate plasterwork, Ali Ghapi royal structure seemed to combine the administrative and leisurely faces of the Safavid state. Yet, despite its administrative and leisurely functions, the royal state house could not remain entirely free of religious symbolism. Reportedly, after his 1632 conquest of Baghdad, Abbas brought from Najaf one of the gates to Ali's shrine and installed it in the entrance portal of Government House as a sign of his devotion to the first Shi'i imam. The Shah himself, despite his well-known propensity toward revelry, also had to underscore his humility toward Shi'i foundations of the Safavid state. One of the self-effacing epithets Abbas assumed for himself was the dog of Ali's threshold, Chelbe Ostani Ali, which denoted not only devotion to Ali, but also to the Safavid state's guarding of the legitimate Shi'i state, a concept rivaling perhaps the Ottomans' assumption of custodianship of the sacred shrines of Mecca and Medina. Beyond the royal state house were extensive royal gardens, stretching all the way to another of Abbas's urban innovations, the Avenue of Chahar Bagh. The idea of Chahar Bagh had long been expressed in gardens, as well as in Persian paintings and carpet designs in Iran, in Central Asia, and in Mughal India. The transposition of the celestial ideal in the Chahar Bagh of Isfahan no doubt reflected the leisurely dimension of the new age of Abbas and the material affluence of the Safavid elite, the mercantile classes, and other associated groups. The 2-mile-long, 196-foot-wide Khiaban, a Persian garden pathway with a watercourse, which later evolved into the modern notion of a boulevard, ran the length of the city from north to south in a newly developed sector close to the river, with parallel lines of plane, cypress, and poplar trees and water channels running across it. Crossing Zayander Rood via the picturesque bridge of Allah Verdi Khan, later the Siyose Pul, another edifice of the Safavid era, the upper Chahar Bagh merged into vast royal parks and gardens in the southern end, which were open to the public. The Chahar Bagh quarter as a whole represented a pleasure garden on a large, orderly scale. The shaded and well-irrigated promenade was open to the public, an inviting refuge for strolling. The avenue of Chahar Bagh crossed the river perpendicularly, crossing Isfahan and its immediate hinterland. Within each plot of land that was developed into a symmetrical garden, delicate pavilions were constructed at the cross-section, or eye, of the garden. Having no residential function, the pavilions in the late Safavid era were built for pure visual and sensual pleasure amid the controlled natural environment, recalling the pavilions, Ghorafat, of paradise, as they were depicted in the Perso-Shi'i eschatological narratives. Under the rule of Abbas's successors, the pleasure aspect of the Chahar Bagh was further emphasized, for instance, in the extant pavilion of Hasht Behesht, built at the end of the 17th century. The name and design of the building alluded to the pleasures of the eighth and final level of paradise, and especially in the sensual license available to the saved. In constructing Chahar Bagh and the surrounding gardens and parks, Abbas and his successor may have been influenced by 17th-century European urban planning. The print illustrations of Italy's Renaissance gardens and villas, for example, were available in Isfahan through European travellers. The Chahar Bagh project never neglected the Shah's entrepreneurial instincts. Abbas acquired vineyards and orchards in the vicinity and developed them into spacious plots to be sold to the nobility and members of the elite. Remarkably, however, the endeavour did not result only in a residential quarter for the affluent, but rather a horticultural delight for pleasure and for the education of the senses. As much as Abbas and his successors were experimenting with new modes of commerce and economic development, so were they tasting the pleasures of wine and companionship. A new economy. Financing a well-equipped army and monumental building projects required new monetary and human resources incompatible with the capacity of an agrarian economy. relying largely on trickling land revenues from fiefdoms under the control of the Ghezil Bash and the provincial nobility, Abbas's predecessors had compensated for the gaping shortfall through limited revenue from overland trade and other urban sources. Whether the cause of the shortfall was insubordinate fiefholders or ailments inherent to fiscal management, the state had to look for alternative resources. Revenue through booty was of diminishing returns, upon which the Safavids could never rely as heavily as did the Ottomans during their expansion. Long before Abbas's time, there was simply little left for the Safavids to conquer. Losing the eastern half of Anatolia, and later the western Caucasus, to the Ottomans was a further blow to the state revenue. Abbas resorted to a range of new economic policies aimed not only to reverse the semi-autonomous power of the periphery in favour of the centre, but also to generate new sources of wealth. His search for new markets, labour, and monopolies complemented his strategies for better communication and for long-distance trade. His economic interventionist policies and deliberate mix of business and government heralded a political economy in tune with the European state mercantilism of his age. Perhaps not as systematic as the English or Dutch, but surely as determined. By around 1600, when Abbas seriously embarked on building the new capital, he had already laid the foundation for a new economy. The cornerstone of his economic reform policy was to shift the landholding pattern from hereditary fiefdoms to state-controlled renewable land tenures, tayal, assigned as estates to the members of the Persian and Golam elite. Still bestowed as remuneration for their services in place of a cash salary, the recipients of these estates were periodically reassigned to various posts and locations, making their estates' tax revenue more readily collectible. The vast expansion of the crown lands, Khaser, moreover, including the entire silk-producing provinces of Gilan and Mozandaran, which were either conquered by Abbas or were estates expropriated from insubordinate Ghezil Bash chiefs, increased the revenue of the crown, which was administered independent of the Divan. Unlike the prevailing Ottoman Timar and the Mughal Subah landholding practices, whereby the central government received services instead of revenue, the shift to a more centralized landholding regime endowed Abbas with additional income from both crown and divan, as well as with exchangeable commodities. This in turn allowed for a commercial venture with a profit margin that no other source, neither land nor taxation, could generate. Silk was the most plausible, perhaps the only cash commodity at Abbas's disposal in order to compensate for the paucity of other non-agrarian source of wealth. Originally introduced to Iran from China, for more than a millennium, silk, abrisham, from Old Persian, uparayishma, or the superior thread, was produced in commercial quantities in Iran and was processed, woven, and exported in raw form or as fine fabrics to Europe through ports along the Black Sea and Eastern Mediterranean. References in the Sasanian sources of late antiquity to Perso-Byzantine rivalry over the silk trade, and in Persian poetry and historiography of the early Islamic Middle Ages, confirm the importance of silk as a commodity, as well as its cultural place in the Persian imagination. By the late 16th century, when European consumption was on the rise, disruption of the so-called Silk Road trade lowered the importation of silk overland from China through Central Asia, an ancient trade route that two centuries earlier had attracted Genoese merchants, famously pioneered by Marco Polo and his party, to Iranian silk-producing centres, and probably to China. Cultivation of Persian silk, inferior in quality to Chinese silk, nevertheless was given a boost after the Safavid conquest of the Caucasus, especially the silk-producing region of Nakhchivan and Shirvan. Both the Iranians and the Ottomans coveted the two regions even before the inception of the Safavid state. The organization and expansion of the Safavid silk trade, however, had to circumvent a serious barrier. Conscious of Persian competition, for most of the 15th century, the Ottoman authorities, like their Byzantine predecessors in Sasanian times, imposed strict restrictions on the import of Persian silk to Ottoman silk markets and silk weaving centres such as Bursa, as well as on its export through their Mediterranean and Black Sea ports. The ongoing religious and political hostilities between the two empires turned such restrictions to a virtual blockade, especially after Abbas's counteroffensive against the Turkish occupation of western Iran. Access to the silkworm breeding centres of the Caucasus and control of the overland routes was a source of recurring anti-Safavid belligerence and a powerful incentive for repeated Ottoman eastern campaigns. As resourceful and creative as Abbas was in governing, he simply updated, so to speak, the same callous treatment of the people of the Caucasus as had been done by his predecessors and by his Ottoman neighbours. Congruent with the mercantilist ethics of the early modern empires, he too gave his exploitation of the region's resources a face-saving appearance, one that served his own political and commercial purposes. After more than a century of the Caucasian territories changing hands and scorched-earth warfare conducted by both Turks and Persians, the once-thriving silk-breeding centres of the Caucasus greatly suffered, and the trade hubs of the Julfa, Tiflis, and Shamakhi were on the verge of collapse. Yet, after a series of campaigns leading up to 1604, once Abbas had firmly reasserted Safavid control over the eastern Caucasus, his treatment of the Armenian and Georgian communities began to shift from crusading zeal to entrepreneurial circumspection. To him, the Armenian communities of the Caucasus, and particularly Julfa, in the present-day Autonomous Republic of Nakhvan in the Azerbaijan Republic, a major Armenian centre of silk production and commerce even with Europe, served a valuable end. As part of his effort to develop his new capital, and as an overall endeavour to strengthen the centre against the periphery, he embarked on a policy of forced migration. In 1605, retreating from an Ottoman counteroffensive in Kars, as part of the scorched-earth military strategy, the Safavid army razed the city of Julfa to the ground. Abbas issued a decree forcing the entire population of the city, some 15,000 Armenian families, probably as many as 100,000 individuals, out of their homeland and distributing them throughout Azerbaijan, Gilan, and other silk-producing northern provinces. A select population, as many as 3,000 families, resettled in the capital, Isfahan, where most were housed in a then-recently created Armenian quarter known as New Julfa, on the south bank of Zayan Derud. By a royal decree, the new quarter was assigned exclusively to the Armenians, and they were offered funding and materials to develop their new home and build numerous churches and mansions. Some Armenian refugees perished along the way from disease and exhaustion, even though after their arrival they were generally treated well by the Safavid authorities. To the Ottomans, mass exodus, Bayak Sergan, was a familiar practice, rooted in the Mongolian and Timurid culture of treating humans as movable herds, and was often aimed to pacify some newly conquered territory. With an eye on that Ottoman practice, Shah Abbas no doubt viewed mass exodus as a canny solution to a century of Perso-Ottoman rivalry over the Caucasus and an effective way to quell repeated anti-Safavid Georgian and Armenian revolts. The greater incentive, and a novel motive for Abbas, was to transplant to his capital Armenian expertise in organizing and operating the Persian silk trade, a move no doubt inspired by the existence of an extensive Armenian trade network and relative immunity of the Armenian and Jewish merchants in crossing the Perso-Ottoman borders, despite hostilities with rival neighbors. With the growth of New Julfa and the thriving economy of the Armenian community, an important piece of Abbas's designs for expanding the silk trade fell into place. By 1615, he was ready to declare silk production and export to be a monopoly of the crown, though earlier he had already commissioned first Jewish, then Armenian merchants as his agents and offered them royal protection and privileges. The Armenian network, extending throughout the Ottoman Empire and European Mediterranean, was a major asset for the Shah's enterprise, functioning almost as an equivalent to the emerging European trading companies, the English East India Company and the Dutch East India Company, and for a while successfully competing with them. The nurturing of an Armenian mercantile network was Abbas's answer to the Ottoman blockade of what would potentially be his most profitable commodity. Despite an increasingly lucrative European silk market, however, Persian raw silk could not be exported conveniently through Levantine ports, primarily because of the high tariffs on it imposed by the Ottomans and other obstacles to overland trade. By the end of the 16th century, Persian silk was one of the most important items exported through Aleppo, then the busiest eastern Mediterranean entrepot. The search for an alternative route had already preoccupied Abbas and his administration, primarily because the Shah's low profit margins stood in glaring contrast to the high proceeds that the Persian silk trade generated for the Armenian and Jewish intermediaries and for the Ottoman treasury. If the advantage of employing Armenian merchants was to access the European markets directly in hopes of realizing higher profits, the overland silk route through the Mediterranean did not fully serve that purpose. To further develop silk production, the Shah also experimented with mass migration of the Armenians and Georgians of the Shamakhi and Tiflis regions to the Caspian province of Gilan, Iran's largest silkworm breeding region. The goal of this venture was to benefit from the new immigrants' expertise in silkworm breeding in a province where high mortality from malaria resulted in chronic labor shortages. In central Iran, in several villages near Isfahan, Abbas also resettled Caucasian Christians to combat population deficiencies, especially where a larger agricultural labor force was needed to boost the new economy. As an extension of the older pattern set up under Tahmasp, the Georgians and Armenians under Abbas and his successors not only settled in New Julfar or in Isfahan itself or in the countryside, they came to occupy vital posts in the Safavid army and administration. Converting to Islam, Armenian and Georgian ghulams, whether captured or purchased, served in high posts. Most influential among them was Allah Verdi Khan, Gift of God, a remarkable Armenian slave soldier and convert to Islam, who rose through the ranks during Abbas's many campaigns to become a commander of the Safavid army and then governor-general of Greater Fars that included the coasts and ports of the Persian Gulf. The Christian element in the age of Abbas as merchants, artisans, soldiers, and administrators had a far greater impact on the state and society proportionate to their population. Under Abbas, Armenians rose in status through the army and trade and were the chief beneficiaries of royal favor, far surpassing indigenous Jewish and Zoroastrian minorities. They were viewed as a window to the outside world and a key medium for enticing and sustaining Europe's diplomatic and commercial interests toward Iran. Material evidence for the tolerant Safavid policy toward the Armenian community is evident not only in New Julfar's public buildings, markets, bathhouses, and bridges, but also in the residences of the affluent Armenian mercantile community. Numerous churches were built throughout the 17th century, some of which are among the best examples of Persian religious architecture. By the 1660s, New Julfar had 24 Armenian churches, as well as several missionary houses and chapels. The best known, Holy Saviour Cathedral, popularly known today as the Vank Cathedral, was financed by an affluent Armenian merchant and completed in 1664. Displaying an excellent adaptation of Armenian tradition to the Persian architectural style, the domed structure and the elaborate arched nave replicated the architecture of Persian mosques. What made the cathedral distinct, however, were the interiors, adorned with frescoes executed by a number of local Armenian painters and showing the life of Jesus, the apostles, and the saints of the Armenian church. The magnificent central panel, which depicts a striking scene of the resurrection, not only evokes Byzantine and Venetian themes, but also the Safavid Shi'i engagement with the themes of return and the hereafter. Such a conjunction was no coincidence, since the Armenians were important partners in the Safavid enterprise of broadening the Persian commercial and cultural horizons. Looking to the West. Owing either to his political savvy or to his business instincts, Abbas came to recognize the power of the new Europe early in his reign and to value its strategic, commercial, and technological potential. In contrast to his predecessors, and indeed to many of his contemporaries, he could see the advantage of interacting with the West and selectively adopting what it had to offer. If anything, he was a bit West-toxicated, garb-zadeh, to borrow the fashionable 20th century label anachronistically. Yet he was confident enough in his own cultural identity not to be carried away entirely with Europe's marvels and its artful representatives. That his gaze was directed toward Europe at a time when European commercial imperialism was on the rise, though not yet dominant, was not a sheer coincidence. Europe's presence was already tangible to the Persians as early as 1507, when a small Portuguese fleet under the command of the adventurous admiral Afonso de Albuquerque raided the strategic island of Hormuz at the head of the Persian Gulf and subordinated the local ruler, a tributary to Iran. The local population repelled him. Late in 1515, Albuquerque, now at the head of a much larger fleet, recaptured Hormuz. This time, he established the Portuguese as the dominant power in the Persian Gulf, which would last for more than a century. The island of Bahrain, another Safavid tributary at the opposite end of the Persian Gulf, fell to the Portuguese in 1521. However, attempts to capture the port of Basra, then a fragile Safavid possession, failed. The loss of Hormuz to the Portuguese was Iran's first experience of European imperial expansion. For more than a century, passage through the Cape of Good Hope and Portuguese control of strongholds throughout the waterways of the Eastern Hemisphere created a web of commercial monopolies, and trade from the Persian Gulf with India, southern China, East Africa, and the Western Mediterranean was only one component of this network. The Portuguese monopoly on the lucrative export of Persian silk through the south imposed an almost total control of the customs tariffs and maritime access to and from the Persian Gulf up to the first quarter of the 17th century. This was an important competition for Venetians' control of the silk trade of the Eastern Mediterranean and their access to the European markets. Portuguese relations with the Safavid state, however, remained ambivalent at best and brazenly intrusive at worst. Earlier, at the outset of the 15th century, Ismail I, who lacked a navy, could neither evict them nor make them pay the tribute he received from the rulers of Hormuz. After long negotiations, therefore, he was persuaded to enter an anti-Ottoman pact with the Portuguese, which, in the aftermath of the disastrous Battle of Chaldiran in 1514, he could hardly afford to implement. Facing the Ottoman blockade in the Mediterranean, the monopoly of the Portuguese was a further impediment to the growth of the Safavids' independent silk export. Reorientation toward the Persian Gulf heralded Iran's reliance on this southern artery to access the markets of Western Europe. Massive injections of New World gold and silver into the markets of Asia and Africa had given Spain, which from 1580 to 1640 was in union with Portugal, enormous purchasing power and political acumen that could not have gone unnoticed even in remote and hard-to-access Safavid Iran. The difficulties Iran faced getting access to the Mediterranean or the Persian Gulf were complicated by other geopolitical concerns. From the perspective of the Spanish Habsburgs, Iran was a natural ally against Ottoman expansion in the Mediterranean and in Central Europe, where the Austrian Habsburgs were under constant Turkish pressure. Abbas, who came to realize the advantages of a European alliance early in his reign, wished to complement the anti-Ottoman pact with a viable commercial bond. Yet major problems hindered his liberation from geographical isolation and his ability to nurture relations with European powers beyond the strictly formal. The Turkish barrier made a steady line of communication through the Mediterranean next to impossible, since Ottoman provincial governors often arrested and imprisoned emissaries passing through Ottoman territories. Even a simple exchange of correspondence over the land route took months, if not years. Alternative routes through the Cape of Good Hope or via the Caspian Sea through Russia and the Baltics proved logistically as hazardous and subject to the whims of either the Portuguese or the Russian Grand Duchy of Muscovy. Yet as early as 1521, the Grand Duchy and Safavid Iran established diplomatic relations. Growth of the Kazan trade in the Caspian through Astrakhan, Baku, and Derbent, fear of Ottoman expansion in the Caucasus, and the recurring problem of Cossack pirates raiding Caspian shores brought Russian emissaries to Abbas's court. Abbas's growing fame in Europe as an anti-Turkish champion brought to Iran, especially from the 1590s, a string of soldiers of fortune, missionaries and merchants with various intents and degrees of sincerity. The poor quality of the missions and the uncharted domain of diplomacy further exacerbated difficult communication. Safavid Iran unavoidably found itself in the midst of intricate European politics, which were divided by sectarian strife, commercial and maritime rivalries, and wars of succession. Toward the end of the 16th century, Spain, under Philip II, was at the height of its colonial expansion and interventionist phase. Philip's anti-Protestant zeal, not unlike the Ottoman anti-Shi'i policies, sharpened Europe's sectarian discord. The Ottoman-Habsburg race for supremacy in the Mediterranean, which reached a climax during the 1571 Battle of Lepanto, also echoed in Safavid Iran and came to influence the nature of its relations with the outside world. Despite a cultural divide and geographical distance, by the late 16th century, Iran's geopolitical destiny was curiously tied up with Europe's. Safavid rulers' correspondence with European courts often rhetorically questioned the futility of the religious schism that divided Christian Europe while the Turkish threat was at hand. It was as though the reality of the Sunni-Shi'i conflict, of which they were the main party, did not sober them enough to the complexity of European sectarian and imperial rivalries. In 1598, 10 years after the destruction of the Spanish Armada by the English, when the English Shirley brothers, Anthony and Robert, and their company of about 20 Englishmen arrived in the Safavid court offering their services, they still wished to present Abbas with the illusion of a unified European front against the Ottomans. Previously in the service of Robert Devereux, 2nd Earl of Essex, partaker in the exploits of Francis Drake and Walter Raleigh, on whose behalf they hoped to develop commercial ties with Safavid Iran, the Shirleys were typical English high-born adventurers in search of fame and fortune. Their claim to have introduced artillery to Safavid Iran and modernized its army can be safely dismissed. In reality, during nearly 3 decades of dealings with the Safavid monarch, they provided him with much information about Europe and European powers, as well as the possibilities of trade and political alliances, even though much of what they said was likely to have been coloured by their proclivities for fame and fortune. This is particularly true about Anthony Shirley, the older of the two, who in 1599, along with the Persian emissary Hossein Ali Beg Bayat, a courtier of Ghazilbash origin, was sent on a goodwill mission to the European courts to promote trade and to coordinate a counter-offensive against the Ottomans, a mission that ended most grotesquely. Quarrelling with the Persian emissary in Prague and later in Rome, where they were to deliver the Shah's message of friendship to Pope Clement VII, Anthony parted with the bales of silk entrusted to him by the Shah to be sold in Europe, apparently to cover travel expenses. He pocketed the proceeds before skipping on to another of his adventures, this time in Italy. He may also have made available to a Turkish agent the contents of the Shah's confidential correspondence. The Persian mission nevertheless proceeded, reaching Spain in 1601, but nothing concrete emerged there, as Spain was then rapidly losing ground to Dutch and British commercial contenders in the east. More embarrassing for the Persian mission, however, was the conversion to Catholicism of a number of Persians in Hossein Ali Beg's retinue, of whom Uruh Beg Bayat is the best known. Although other lower-ranking members of the mission had already defected to Catholicism in Rome, it was Uruh Beg's conversion that received attention. Under Philip III's auspices, he was baptized in the Castilian capital, Valladolid, as Don Juan of Persia. His conversion may have been inspired by the splendor of the Spanish court, or perhaps the glitter of the unveiled women, or even the persuasion of the overzealous Jesuits. Don Juan survived to co-author and publish in 1604 a remarkable account in the Catalan language of the history of Iran, his own life, and the mission that brought him to Spain, perhaps the earliest such chronicle by a living Persian in any European language. Only a year later, however, he was killed in a brawl in Valladolid. His murder was possibly related to the hostilities prompted by the Spanish Inquisition that eventually led to the 1609 expulsion of the last of the Moriscos, the former Muslims and crypto-Muslims, from Spanish soil. The failure of this mission did not discourage Abbas from dispatching or receiving other European missions, nor was it the end of the Shirley brothers. Anxious to press further in his objective, trade through the Persian Gulf, and to build on shared anti-Ottoman sentiments, Abbas sent Mahdi Goli Beg to the European courts, where he was received by the Polish monarch Sigismund III and later by Emperor Rudolf II of the Holy Roman Empire. Later in 1608, the Shah dispatched to the Spanish court yet another mission, this time headed by Robert Shirley. The Hispano-Portuguese influence then waning, the mission was aimed at a new European maritime contender. Already, Abbas's recapture of the island of Bahrain from the Portuguese in 1602, and shortly thereafter the port of Gamberon, which overlooked the Strait of Hormuz, had dimmed his chances of any collaboration with the Iberian power. Instead, the Shah was persuaded to turn to the English as an alternative trading and strategic partner. Robert Shirley, dressed as a Gezilbash and bearing the title of Khan, which he had earned for his many years of military service to the Shah, was something of a sensation when he reached London in 1611, perhaps the first Persianized exotica to hit fashion-conscious Europe of the time. Although he returned empty-handed, due to resistance by the pro-Ottoman English Levantine Company's lobby, for a while the Persian dress style, perhaps inspired by Shirley, became fashionable in the Stuart court. Abbas's diplomacy worked, to the extent that it not only opened Iran to European commerce and curiosity, but also forged stronger bonds with Mughal India and eventually with the Shaybanid Uzbeks of Central Asia. The primary motives, invariably, were trade, but also security and cultural exchanges, especially with the Mughal court. Despite occasional friction over the control of Kandahar province, which eventually fell to Safavid Iran in the late 17th century, Mughal rulers generally felt a strong cultural affinity for Iran. Such cultural integration is evident in a number of allegorical Mughal paintings, which often display Abbas, albeit unrealistically, as a junior partner to the Mughal emperor. Moreover, numerous missions from Spain, England, Venice, the Netherlands, and Poland, as well as from Prague, Muscovy, Rome, and later German principalities, arrived in Isfahan, though few achieved results as concrete as the English, and shortly thereafter the Dutch, trading companies. Although somewhat independent of the English crown, the East India Company conducted business, even at its inception, not entirely unmindful of the English strategic interests. Its first ship reached the Iranian port of Jaskeh on the Gulf of Oman in 1616, only 16 years after the company's investiture. By the time it arrived in Jaskeh, a port that had long been serving Indo-Persian and East African trade through Muscat, the English company had already won important concessionary privileges from the Safavid court. Abbas allowed the Honourable Company, as it was known, to establish a trading factory, but did not grant it the right to build strongholds, being well aware of the strategic importance of Portuguese coastal fortresses throughout the hemisphere. He also lifted tariffs on English imports and exports as an incentive to compete against the Portuguese monopoly. The growth of English trade facilitated Iran's access to European markets, although it did not dislodge the Portuguese altogether. Evident in Safavid correspondence of the time is displeasure with the Portuguese maltreatment of Persian merchants, especially after the expulsion of the Portuguese from Gamberon in 1614, renamed Bandar Abbas in honour of its liberator. Anti-Portuguese sentiments were backed by Shi'i polemics and fuelled by the anti-Jesuit propaganda of the English Reformation. By 1622, the Shah felt confident enough to let the powerful Governor-General of Fars province, Allah Verdi Khan, pressure the East Indian Company into collaborating in a raid against the Portuguese to recapture Hormuz Island, a long-time strategic ambition of the Safavid rulers. To compensate for the lack of a naval force, a chronic Iranian weakness in guarding its southern shores, the Persian troops were transported on board English ships to the island, where they successfully drove away the demoralized garrison. Portuguese attempts to regain it failed. The loss of Hormuz, a prosperous stronghold, was a serious blow to the Portuguese presence and the beginning of a long and protracted disintegration of their trading empire. Although they persisted up to 1649 in Muscat, on the opposite coast, their trading privileges were lost to the benefit of the English and, soon after, the Dutch. That the East India Company was a crucial partner in capturing Hormuz, however, did not result in an automatic export monopoly for the English. Sensing the rise of the Dutch seafaring empire as powerful competition for the English, Abbas and his lieutenants welcomed the market forces and the diplomacy they engendered. Consolidated in 1602, the Dutch East India Company, VOC, for Vereenigde Oost-Indische Compagnie, proved financially stronger and commercially more astute than its English counterpart. To his credit, Abbas tried to strike a balance between the English and the Dutch, between southern and northern trade, including the Mediterranean route, and between domestic merchants, mostly the Armenians of New Julfa, and the European trading companies. However, the Safavid reassertion in the Persian Gulf and the return of Gambarun and Hormuz to Iran did not result in the creation of a Safavid naval force or even a merchant fleet. Adhering to a long Persian tradition of land-bound trade, the Safavids invariably preferred to leave high seas adventures to the seafaring Europeans. Even the mighty Ottoman naval power in the Mediterranean and in the early part of the 16th century in the Indian Ocean did not ease Persian navigational anxiety. Having been a land power, the Safavids, similar to the Mughals of Hindustan, had difficulty adopting the sea culture of their southern and northern peripheries. After the Portuguese departure from the 1640s and for more than half a century, the Dutch held a near monopoly on the export of silk, driving English and Armenian competitors out of the market. By the end of the century, the domestic silk exporters, the backbone of the emerging mercantile community, no longer benefited from royal protection. Furthermore, the Armenian community of New Julfa and elsewhere did not feel as secure as they did during the time of Abbas I, even though they had expanded their international trading network throughout Bengal and Southeast Asia, and to Venice and as far west as England. The Jews of Iran, especially of Isfahan, fared worse. Although they seem to have played no significant part in the organization of the government silk trade, in their roles as domestic bankers or as exporters of silk from Kashan to the Persian Gulf, they may have been perceived as competition for the state monopoly. It is possible that the eclipse of the Portuguese trade played a part in the further waning of Jews in the Safavid commercial operation, especially in the south. Ironically, the Portuguese, who had expelled the Jews from their lands, relied on the Jewish diaspora, some seemingly of Iberian stock, to conduct their trade in Iranian silk-weaving centres such as Kashan. It is perhaps not sheer coincidence that from the early decades of the 17th century, Jews were subjects of discrimination and later persecution by the Safavid state, perhaps influenced by the contemporary European and especially Catholic anti-Semitism. The 1622 capture of Hormuz followed a year later by the conquest of the Shi'i holy cities of Iraq, and in 1624 by the capture of Baghdad. Remarkably, this highlight of Abbas's political career, compensated for the absence of a Persian naval expansion, was an excellent option for the Safavid Shah at a time when Ottomans were engaged at their western frontiers. Yet Iran's commercial orientation toward the south continued. Trade through Bandar Abbas and other southern ports was essential for incorporating the Persian Gulf littoral into the Safavid Empire, in much the same way that exporting silk produced in Gilan province through the northern route integrated the Caspian provinces into Safavid Iran and opened trade with Caspian ports of Baku and Astrakhan in the 17th and 18th centuries. Toward the end of Abbas's reign, references to the guarded domains of Iran were used with greater frequency in the Safavid annals as an alternative for the sublime Safavid state. Dolate Aliye Safaviye. Expelling the Portuguese, repelling the Uzbeks, and retaking the Safavid provinces from the Ottomans engendered in Safavid Iran a spirit of confidence and security. Military success was backed by economic prosperity, at least for a period after Abbas's reign. Nearly all European accounts of 17th century Iran confirm a new age of affluence that was facilitated by a more extensive network of domestic and overseas communication, a growing urban population, a nuanced concept of leisure, and a maturing Shi'i intellectual identity. The appeal of an anti-Ottoman alliance with the Europeans swiftly paled once the Safavids achieved tranquility with their western neighbour. A decade after the death of Shah Abbas in 1629, and 16 years after the Safavids' capture of Iraq, renewed hostilities with the rejuvenated Ottoman Empire under Murad IV, reigned 1623 to 1640, led to the 1639 Peace Treaty of Zohab. Under the terms of the treaty, the Safavids relinquished control of all of Iraq, most notably the Shi'i holy cities, to the Ottomans, recognized Turkish sovereignty over the Western Caucasus, and gave the Ottomans a foothold in the Bay of Basra, at the northern tip of the Persian Gulf. In exchange, the Ottomans recognized Iranian sovereignty over the Eastern Caucasus, consisting of Nakhchivan, Armenia, Karabagh, the two central and eastern Georgian principalities of Kartil and Kakheti, as well as the whole of Azerbaijan, the western Iranian provinces, and Bahrain. The peace proved enduring, at least for another century, until the end of the Safavid period.